This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on the head-on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there.
We are back, my dear podcast listeners, back for another season of revealing behind the scenes podcasts with the biggest names in the sport of sailing. Wherever you listen to us from, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you've been able to find some time to get out on the water. It's been a busy summer here in Cowes. We've had a short summer break away from the podcast, but we've still been putting in the hours. We've got a few fascinating interviews lined up for you over the next few editions. And we start this season with a chat with one of the sport of sailing's biggest names. More of that in a second. Thanks to everyone that got in touch at the end of season three. Your support means a lot. And to those of you that have tuned in on YouTube to check out my season of double-handed offshore sailing, a big thanks as well. Since our last podcast, I managed to sail non-stop all the way around Britain and Ireland. Double-handed, of course, with one-time podcast guest and undisputed British offshore legend, Dee Cafari. Dee and I spent 2 weeks on the race, a very light wind affair. I don't think either of us were originally expecting it to take so long. And we filmed the entire way around. If you're interested in offshore sailing and want to check it out, head over to the podcast page on YouTube. There's a 6-part behind-the-scenes series of our offshore summer, culminating in the big 1,800-mile race around Britain and Ireland. Let us know what you think. Well, back to the podcast. I can't quite believe we're on to season four already. 3 seasons already in the bag. And if you're new to the pod, check out the previous editions. There's hours and hours of behind-the-scenes chat with some of our sport's biggest names. And for this season, we've decided to keep going with buymeacoffee.com. So thanks to everyone that's helped support the pod. It makes a big difference, and if you enjoy listening to our ad-free podcast and want to support, then it's all very simple. Go to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. It's super quick, super easy, and it's greatly appreciated. Right, back to this month's guest, and we're starting this edition on a very special anniversary. 39 years to the day since the sport of sailing changed forever. 39 years since the longest ever winning streak in world sport finally came to an end. 39 years since this month's guest skippered Australia 2 across the finish line to end 132 years of America's Cup dominance by the New York Yacht Club. We talk about these numbers a lot in the media, but think about it. 132 years in sport is phenomenal. The statistics around the Cup are quite astonishing. And it wasn't until 1983 that a challenging syndicate managed to wrestle the trophy away from New York and change the face of international sailing. At the helm, a 36-year-old John Bertrand, by then an Olympic bronze medalist in the fin class, competing in his fourth America's Cup and sailing the famed Australia 2 for Aussie property tycoon Alan Bond. It was a landmark moment, not just in sailing, but in global sport. And a moment that opened up the world of the America's Cup to a whole host of competition-hungry nations, buoyed by the fact that finally, winning this elusive cup was an achievable feat. We talked to John earlier this summer. England was enjoying a hot spell, and John was over from Australia, staying deep in the idyllic East Sussex countryside with his wife, Rasa. You can hear the evidence of the British summer outside as John and I take a wonderful stroll down a memory lane, absolutely bristling with sailing folklore. I hope you enjoy the time I spend with John Bertrand.
And you never bet against the Yanks, you know, they'll eat their grandmother if required. I then started to love the smell of gunpowder. I loved competition. 1970, it was lambs to the slaughter.
John, you've been top of our podcast wish list since we began all those years ago. And here you are, finally. It's been well worth the wait. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my great pleasure.
We've tracked you down in the wonderful English countryside, just outside Brighton. The cows are mooing outside. The birds are tweeting, hopefully not too loudly, outside the door. What have you been up to? What brings you here?
Our family, our son and daughter-in-law and granddaughters. That's our number one priority. And then in addition to that, we met up with some great friends. We hooked up to at the Mercedes F1 headquarters with Ben Ainsley, and he showed us around what they're doing with Ineos. Fascinating stuff. Mercedes F1 employ 3,000 people up there. It's remarkable. Big business. Anyway, so the Ineos thing was really of great interest. No pictures allowed, of course. We've been having a beautiful time here in the UK, and also we initially came across as I'm captain of Team Australia for the Star Sailors League Gold Cup. So we met the organisation and helped in the inaugural launch in Lausanne earlier in our trip.
Well, I saw you and Rasa there just a couple of weeks ago in Switzerland. I mean, it was incredible, wasn't it? In the Olympic Museum, and there you were on stage in a panel of sailing royalty. But it was different, John, when you stood up and spoke. I mean, the whole room hung on your every word. The voice of experience, yet still a very fresh perspective. I was curious if you get that, how people really listen to what you have to say.
Well, I'm not a professional sailor. You know, I never have been, even though there's Olympic program and America's Cup, all consuming. But in, you know, my era, there was no money there. So it was amateur. But you know that, you know, you with all your Olympic experience and Olympic gold medals, plural, money was not part of it. It was just the dream. It was this passion. And that still is the case with the people in the audience. You know, most of these people, some of them are professional sailors, but others are just pure, you know, just love the idea of going higher, further and faster. And that's where I come from. You know, when I was a little boy and when we first went sailing in a Sabo, I was mesmerized by the bubbles going past. And it still is of great interest to me, even though, sailing on different boats. I just, the concept of no sound other than wind-driven, vehicles, I'm a romantic person in that regard.
You dodged the question a bit. I mean, I just felt you had a real presence there, and I sensed that in the room, which was really lovely to see. I mean, how important is sailing still in your life? You're Etchells Racing, I guess, and still loving it.
I love it, yes. You know, it's my passion, the Etchells. It's, pure One Design Racing. And it's, in Australia, we race against the best operators in the country. You know, we've had a program on the Sydney Harbour. My boat's up at Sydney. I live in Melbourne, but up at the Royal Sydney Yacht Squadron. And, you've got Ian Murray and Matt Belcher and Olympic gold medalists and America's Cup sailors and all on the start line duking it out and then trying to play the wind shifts on Sydney Harbour. It's really cool. It's fantastic. And I've been recently sailing with a four-man person team. I rang up my good friend Victor Kovalenko, the medal maker. And I said, I need your help, Victor. And I said, I need three young guns on the boat. So Victor produced three 470 sailors. One is 52 kilograms. it's just great stuff. And I really enjoy the, pulling that little team together as well over the winter time.
You need all three of them to pull the guy back. Okay. Yeah. So, you've had some massive names sail with you in the Etchells. Sir Ben Ainsley, Tom Slingsby, Glenn Ashby, Tim's cycling buddy, the famous coach Dog Palfrey. I mean, it's been a factory of talent.
Yes. Yes, I'm in a situation where basically people say no. That they do not say no, I should say, when asked them. So for better or worse, that's, from my perspective, that's just fantastic. So Yeah, I remember when coming back from London in the plane with Raza quite a few years ago, and decided to get a new Etchells, and she said, "Who's going to crew for you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not really sure." So she said, "Why don't you get Ben?" I said, "Why not?" So I gave him a call and I said, "Let's do it." So Ben came across and we won the Nationals, and we were close to winning the Worlds, which still irks Ben and myself, but we didn't win it. But it was just fantastic, and having Doggy on the boat as well. So, you know, I reckon that was a hot team.
I love that. I guess when John Bertrand calls you up, you just say yes. I've spoken to Tom Slingsby about you, and for him, it was really life-changing sailing with you. Not only did you go on to win the Worlds with him, but subsequently he became a true friend, and you're a real mentor. He said you're the first call if he needs a hand with some tricky decisions. I mean, that's a special relationship. It must mean a lot.
Yes, it is. Yes, I'm fortunate to, you might say, be a mentor to a few of these characters around the place. And Tommy is, yeah, when we first met him, he really couldn't put two words together. He was so shy, a shy laser sailor. How it happened is that Ben had other things to do in terms of America's Cup, so he couldn't continue on with the program, which was to endeavour to win the Worlds in Ireland way back in 2010, actually. So Doggy was involved, and he said, "Look, we should have a chat to this young kid, Tom Slingsby." So got Tom along, and he was so shy, he'd sit on the couch, he wouldn't say boo, you know, come out on the boat, and all of a sudden he was alive, this kid, you know, so tuned in to wind and water and wind shifts and clouds, and he was just fantastic, you know, the natural talent. So it was just wonderful to, anyway, so Tommy joined us, and we went on, we won the Worlds, and it was, the combination was fabulous, and again, you know, helping, you know, this young boy grow. You know, he's now a man, of course, and watching him and helping him, you know, with his career to a little bit. That's of great, you know, I have a great pleasure in doing that.
Slingsby's really on fire now, isn't it? I mean, his stock's high. What was your advice when he was offered a role at American Magic?
I've known about it for quite a while, and it really got down to, my opinion, it got down to the respect that the syndicate had to have for Tommy for it to work. And that was really the key. So it was really the negotiation and for Tommy not to jump in, you know, with his nationality rule. He only had, well, basically had no choice. So it's worked out very well, I think. And I think that he'll be fully utilised now that, you know, the results at the Sail GP, it's a phenomena what Tommy and his team are doing at the moment. And he'll be fully utilised with that America's Cup project. But it's all about respect. You know, again, because of the respect between these individuals. You know, Tommy and Paul have been around quite a while now, cross paths. And, you know, one of these things, any of these things, it's about when an organisation focuses externally instead of internally. If it's internal, where there's a battle, whatever, then that can tear the organisation apart. It's like cancer. But if indeed the so-called enemy is external, then all hands to the pumps. And I think that will be the case, almost certainly.
John, we have a lot to talk about. Normally at this point, I delve back into your childhood. But with you, your sailing story starts way before you were even born. Your family has a long-standing relationship with the America's Cup. Tell us about that.
Well, my great-grandfather was an engineer in Southampton, where Sir Thomas Lipton's boats were built. And, you know, the family stories goes back way back then when he was involved in building two of the Shamrocks in that era. And the best engineers in this era of the world were Scottish. So the Scottish engineers used to work on this project, typically 9 months to build. And some of them stayed at my grandfather, great-grandfather and great-grandmother's home in Southampton. So it goes back a long way. You might say blood, you know, has flowed a long time from that era. And of course, five America's Cups, Sir Thomas never won it. He certainly spread his tea empire into the United States, but so the America's Cup's been part of our family history for a long time. Not that when I was a little boy was it of great interest, but when I look back, it's still part and parcel, of who I am.
How much did you know about the Cup growing up?
It was one of those things where my first real interest was when Gretel won, surfed past Weatherly, way back, and I was listening as a little boy on the wireless, called the radio now, in Newport, Rhode Island, and that would have been 1962. That's when John F. Kennedy was president of the United States and Jackie, the whole thing. And they were carrying a Ted Hood spinnaker, which was later banned by the Americans. but Jock Sturrock, who then became Australian of the Year, based on that. Isn't that extraordinary?
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
that's a good story. Good times. Your book's called Born to Win, and I was wondering if that was why, because you have this extraordinary legacy in the Cup.
That's right. Yes. Well, I wrote the book, and I'm really happy I did, because it was a purge for me. You know, everyone has their own story of doing stuff. Okay, and certainly myself with the Australia to America's Cup project. So in hindsight, it was good to get it out on paper and then I could get on with my life. But the original title was To Take You Home from Within Jonathan Livingston Seagull. There's this passage there to take you home. And when the publishers in America saw it, they said, well, it's not a pick-me-up title. There's something like, I don't know what the numbers are, a couple of thousand books released every day in America. And it's all about a pick-me-up title. And they said, what's different about this guy? This is in New York. And they, you know, within the book, we talk about my great-grandfather and said, well, Born to Win. It's all about Born to Win. I struggled with the title, I must say, because in Australia we have this tall poppy syndrome about, you know, cutting people down if they look like they've got too big a head. But then I thought one of the things that holds our country back, Australia, is this whole issue of not, you know, standing up and being proud of success, you know, unlike American, because we lived in the US for quite a while, I went to MIT and did a whole lot of stuff with Rouser, and the Americans are high fives. And you never bet against the Yanks, you know, the Yanks are highly competitive people. They'll eat their grandmother if required. That's how I explain it to people in Australia. And it's one of the things that I think holds our potential back is this, you know, laid back, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So I thought, well, look, in my position of, you know, being the skipper of the America's Cup winning boat, if anyone can help change a culture, then I can in this situation. So we said, let's do it. Born to Win. And that's the title of the book. As it turns out, it's the biggest selling autobiography ever in Australia.
It's a good title and it's a good book. I can vouch for that because I've just reread it. I mean, it's full of incredible nuggets. You don't tire of it. So well done with that, John. You grew up on the beach in the glorious Port Phillip Bay, just to the south of Melbourne. I mean, it would have been pretty hard to avoid messing about on the water. What kind of sailing upbringing did you have? How competitive was the young JB?
Well, it wasn't. I used to get nervous in competition, as I did when I was at school with track and field and whatever. So we just used to muck around in the sabo, my brother and I, sailing up and down the beach. We had no coaching. And that was, we're talking about a long time ago. So we just learned to sail. And the concept of tacking into the wind was a strange phenomenon because we just reach up and down. We had sea breezes at Chelsea, the breeze that comes straight inshore. My mother would wade out in the water at lunchtime and we'd sail past and she'd have a wrap lunch for us. And we'd just continue on. We wouldn't even stop, you know. And then wave a blanket in the late afternoon when it was time to come for dinner. We'd come in. So that was us, summertime. Wintertime we'd play football and summertime muck around in boats. So I really have never had any coaching. It's kind of interesting. Not totally. America's Cup, where Mike Fletcher was involved, but primarily all the racing I've done, again, is pre this super competitive environment. And I think it's also, Shirley, one of the reasons why I still love the sport, because I haven't been burnt out in this whole process. One of the biggest challenges, and we know that, is overcoaching of kids compared to just loving what they're doing.
There's a lot to be said for self-coaching. I think you've definitely got a point there. Well, when did you know then, John, that you were quite good, and how did you approach it? What kind of approach did you have?
Well, I started to then become interested in this competition and then started to win races, including the Sabo Championships, and then got into what we call Vaucluse Junior, which is kind of an almost extinct class in Australia now, certainly worldwide. And they're twin hiking board boats, 12 feet long. And they could go upwind against the Flying Dutchman in 20 knots of breeze, even though there's 12 feet, you know, two kids on it. We'd plane upwind and plane downhill, you know, the wave very, very light, that made out of three ply. And won the National Junior Championships there, went on to win the National, which is the highest performance dinghy, was lightweight Sharpie, a little bit like a Flying Dutchman, and won the National Junior and then Senior Championships and that. So I just love this. I then started to love the smell of gunpowder. I loved competition. And that took us into the world of the America's Cup and then Olympic sailing in the fin class. So that's a story of passion, Shirley. Concept of money, being a professional sailor, it never was not available, nor was it of interest to me relative to just loving what I was doing.
I love the way the Australians design a boat for small children that's faster than the Flying Dutchman. I mean, only the Aussies. It would never happen in the UK.
And 12 feet long.
As you say, you and your brother were winning state and national championships. Sadly, though, your father died when you were only 15 years old. That's a massive moment in a young boy's life. How did it affect you then and after?
Yes, well, Dad worked 7 days a week. You know, we didn't have any money. When Dad died, we didn't have enough money for the funeral. And then Mum had two kids at high school, Mordialloc Chelsea High School, myself. My brother's 2 years, 9 months older, so he's 3 years ahead. And it was one of those situations where, regardless, Mum knew, and Dad, that we had potential if we really want to apply ourselves. So even though we didn't have any money after Dad died, 15, she still was able to save enough money to buy a new VJ, which went on to win the national championships over in Perth. So it's one of these things where, you know, a dedicated parent in this case, and parents when Dad was around, just helped us out if indeed the passion was there. You know, it wasn't easy come, easy go. We'd make all our fittings, for example, down the back shed with Dad. So all the pulleys, all of that sort of thing. Why? Because the fittings that you could buy at the marine store were never light enough compared to what we needed. So pretty much everything we made, except for the actual hulls. And that was our world. So it was a big deal, obviously, when Dad died, 15. And he was a major influence in our life. Mum then had to continue a business which wasn't generating much money. But typical of that, she was able to borrow some money from the local bank after being knocked back three times, borrowed enough money, built a whole, we made teddy bears, Burlex toys, soft toys of teddies and koala bears and so on, took new samples to Sydney, hired the biggest suite at the Hilton Hotel. And instead of going cap in hand with teddies in a suitcase to the major department store, she got the buyers to come to her. So we're not talking about having an MBA from Harvard or anything like this. This is just survival. And she sold a year's production in 1 week. Okay, came back and then rebuilt the business. So it was typical of my parents, you know, sort of never giving up. That's, I guess, part of what runs in the bloodline.
An impressive lady. How important was school to you, John? And at that time, what was the landscape like in Australia for a young talented sailor?
Well, again, school was not that interesting for me. It was kind of a bridge between when I could go sailing as is normally the case. However, I did graduate with enough marks from Mordialloc High School to get a scholarship. I had to do that to get to university. Got to Monash University, and I met a man who changed my life, a man called Professor Bill Melvin, who was in charge of aeronautics at Monash University. And he in turn was a consultant to the Dame Patty 1967 America's Cup Challenge, Dame Patty. So he had obviously an interest, he's an aero engineer, but he changed my life in terms of my interest in the whole area of fluids. And I was able, as a result, when I graduated from Monash, and would you believe my thesis topped the university, and I've never really done much in academia, but again, you know, it's just passionately involved. The title of the thesis were very simple, The Optimum Angle of Attack of America's Cup Sails.
That's using, pretty focused.
Oh, very focused. Using lifting line theory, which is still relevant to today, would you believe, and all that stuff. Got to MIT in the United States, and that was again changed our life because Rance and I just got married and so on and so forth. So school, as it turns out, was a very, very important part of understanding the nuances of the world of engineering and in particular the world of high performance sailing, which included the America's Cup.
How did you get your first taste of the America's Cup world? How did it happen?
When I was invited by Jim Hardy to try out for the 1970 America's Cup Challenge, a project called Gretel 2. And so 1969, went to Sydney, and I stepped on their training boat, a boat called Vim. And I went a 20-ton boat in the water, and I'd been sailing lightweight Sharpies, which are super high performance, you know, playing upwind and downwind everywhere, trapeze driven. And nothing moved. I went from one side of the boat to nothing, the other, just nothing moved. I couldn't believe it, this lead mine, this thing sitting in the water. But at any rate, Jim asked me to be involved in that team, which we did, went to Newport, as Rouse and I were just married. And that was the start of our America's Cup. So that was 1970, then 74, 80, and then 83, yeah.
We'll go back to Newport, 1970. You're port trimmer on Sir Frank Packer's Gretel 2, as you say. I mean, what are your memories of all that, the campaign and being a challenger in Newport, where the Americans owned the cup?
Yeah, well, first of all, Sir Frank Packer was a tough old bastard. He was the middleweight boxing champion of Australia during the Depression, okay? A self-made, in that case, a multimillionaire. He didn't suffer fools. So his first challenge in 1962, so we're now talking about the history of the America's Cup in Australia, really of great interest to the Aussies. So Frank, who controlled media in Australia, he challenged in 62 with Gretel 1, and then Gretel 2 in 1970. So Frank was the Sir Frank. Raza kept him alive. He was suffering lack of oxygen, so she used to give him the oxygen, being a nurse, out on the Newport, Rhode Island, while we're being hammered by the Americans. She used to say, come over here, girly, I need more oxygen. So Raza would come across with the oxygen tank. So 1970, it was lambs to the slaughter. Americans were just so much better in terms of match racing. Our boat was faster. Just slightly faster. Gretel 2 was faster than Intrepid, certainly in light medium conditions. And we won one race, but the fact is the rest of their part just didn't, going out to the first race, for example, we put on a new headsail, which we'd never seen before, which we used in the first race, so the whole program was way behind time. But lots of learnings from a project like that. They were wanting to ban Microsoft software because it was American designed. America's Cup started before the US Civil War. Alan was 34 years old when he challenged for the America's Cup. Technically broke at the time.
How much better were the Americans? How high was the bar?
Oh, very high. They were practiced in the New York Yacht Club system. We've got some beautiful birds outside. Isn't that great? Yeah, we're in the country. The selection process, the New York Yacht Club, multiple races, multiple teams, and they were slick in every area. And they also, they strutted their stuff, you know, the sense of not entitlement, but not far off it. But certainly the owners of the America's Cup. And one thing that became clear to me was this whole issue of the psychology of taking on the United States of America when no one had ever, you know, come within cooey of winning this thing, this crazy event.
Looking back to that period, and obviously the Cup just stayed in New York. It had been there for over a century. I mean, looking back, it wasn't really fair competition, was it? Yet syndicates still went over to take it on.
They certainly did. You know, the so when Gretel won, surf passed Weatherly way back in 1962 with the President of the United States watching, you know, big deal in that era, out on the boat. Australia was using American sailcloth, including Ted Hood design spinnakers. So that was banned thereafter. You know, we had to create our own sailcloth. And everything had to be designed. At one stage, you know, later on in the America's Cups further down the track, further through, they were wanting to ban Microsoft software because it was American designed. You know, so that was their interpretation of New York Club. So they made it pretty hard, clearly. There were a lot of steps and stairs to be able to overcome the New York Yacht Club's interpretation of the deed of gift.
They kept going, though, didn't they, the syndicates? Why? What is that that kept people like Packer going?
It was Everest. No one had ever done. It was a four-minute mile. No one ever got through that invisible barrier. But it was the Everest of not only sailing, but of sport. And that's really what it was. The America's Cup started before the U.S. Civil War. Remarkable and been successfully defended for all different reasons, but generally better organisations, the US syndicates, compared to anything that came up about. And it was that Everest of sport that was there, and it was a fascination to many, many, you know, people, entrepreneurs, including us Australians.
You stayed in the US afterwards, learned the sailmaking business at North Sails, and started Finn campaigning with little resource, pushing for a medal at the Munich Games. Even then, Olympic success was in large part about attention to detail. How did it go?
Well, the 72 Olympics, so basically Robbie Doyle got me into the Finn. He was a medical student at Harvard, and I was doing a postgraduate science degree at MIT. And being beaten up in interclub dinghies on the Charles River, these kids were damn good. You know, the knowledge of the rules and so on. So in between, you know, classes, I'd go out in the interclub dinghies, and the competition was red hot. And also I was with a guy called Jerry Milgram, who was a key designer for the America Cube project for 92 for Bill Koch. You know, what a character Bill is, my God. Crazy, absolutely crazy man. Wonderful, interesting people we're talking about. But so Robbie suggested that we go to the World Championships in Toronto in the Finn whilst we're at university. And I borrowed a MIT Finn with sail and so on, and was able to get seventh in the Gold Cup, 120 boats. So that was the start of the whole Olympic dream. So I was able to fast track my my Master of Science at MIT. With Jerry, who was my overall founding professor, you might say, get back to Australia, won the trials, and competed in the 72 Olympics in Kiel, in Germany, won the leather medal. I remember walking down the great George Bruder. Now, some people would remember Bruder, but he was just remarkable. He was a professor at one of the universities in Brazil. They called him the professor, and he was multiple Gold Cup winner in both the Finn and the Starboat. And he was then a Gold Cup winner in 72 in both classes, I believe, certainly the Finn. He chose the star for the 72 Olympics. He basically finished fourth, and I finished fourth. We walked arm in arm down towards the dais area to be part of the crowd. And he said, John, you realise we've just won the leather medal. I'll never forget that. You know, my God. And it's true. It's worse than last. It's, you know, other than mum and the kids, nobody cares. Get up on that podium, it's a different world.
I checked the points. I mean, it was really close, wasn't it, between you and silver and bronze.
Amazing.
And I've been there too. And I think back, I can still sort of well up about it. It affected me hugely.
Huge.
It's a tough spot.
It certainly is. And you know, all the if onlys of, you know, one race, the racing was actually abandoned, not enough wind, a little bit of current against us, and I got within 50 metres of the finishing line. In hindsight, it could have been a silver. Yeah, all of those if onlys, but that's all part of the sport, isn't it?
There's been a lot of great sailors finished fourth at the Olympics. I remember Tom Slingsby saying on the podcast, you know, always fear the guy who finished fourth time before.
And that's right.
And certainly that was, you know, that was me. It was a catalyst to better things.
Yes.
At this point in your career then, the Australian businessman, Alan Bond, I mean, literally exploded onto the scene. What are your memories of meeting that great character?
Well, put it in context, Alan was 34 years old when he challenged for the America's Cup. Technically broke at the time. He was a property developer. And unless you're close on bankruptcy, you're not trying within the world of property. Out of West Australia, out of the Wild West. And he challenged for this crazy thing called the America's Cup and had, in reality, not much knowledge of what he was talking about. But it was, again, it was an Everest. And his close confidant was Ben Lexon. And Ben said, we've got to do this thing. And so for better or worse, Bondi was in, unbelievable. And swashbuckling entrepreneur out of Perth, Western Australia. One thing that Alan, why did he do it? To be recognised, to be respected. We get back to this word respect. It's very interesting. He could not get a meeting in Wall Street. Alan Bond from Western Australia, from Perth, who cares? And so in hindsight, his business model was to gain the influence to be able to do global deals. I think that's, you know, when you look back on it, because there's no other reason. It's because, and the probability of winning the America's Cup was 1,000 to 1 against or whatever. Who knows? Because no one had ever done it. But anyway, he got involved. And I came back. I graduated from MIT, competed in the 72 Olympics. Benny asked me to be one of the assistant designers with that project. So I was responsible for everything from the deck up. When our first child was born, I'm not proud of it, but 10 days after Lucas was born, I went to Europe for 3 months working on sailcloth development with Bainbridge. You know, it had to be non-American, all of this stuff. Anyway, so we went across to Newport, got blown out of the water. Our boat wasn't quick enough, as it turns out. The crew was pretty good. But again, it was part of the learning curve. So we had some really interesting people in that era, and that was 74. But, you know, we're Yanchep Sun City, home of the America's Cup. Some of the stories for Bondi, he bought 15 kilometres of beach, surf beach north of Perth called Yanchep, painted some of the sand hills green, great, better for the brochures for the British immigrants coming out to Western Australia. I can say that now because Bondi has passed on. But all of these things, you know, it's just part and parcel.
How believable was it? I mean, you've been well beaten in Newport before. You had a sense of what was involved. Was there a moment you thought, he's all bluster?
Well, after 74, I said, no, never again. Amateur hour. It was. It was, you know, totally different to an Olympic campaign. And one of the stories, just to give you a quick overview of Alan, is that running out of money, he sent a note through to Alcan, because at that stage he'd controlled Swan Brewery, a beer manufacturing company in Australia, distribution. And Alcan were the suppliers of the majority of aluminium cans. So he sent a note to the CEO. He said, "Dear Harry, I'd like you to become a proud sponsor of our America's Cup challenge." And Harry then thought he needed this like a hole in the head, but anyway, continued on. And he sent a note to the chairman of the board and said, Mr. Bond would like us to be a sponsor. Though being a very, very important customer, they said, yes, let's do it. So Harry sends a check back for $25,000. And immediately Ellen sent a note straight back to Harry saying, thank you, Harry, for your deposit. So that's how these projects were funded, you know, that leverage point. It's beautiful. So, but at any rate, after the 74, I said, never again, this is amateur hour. Focused on the 76 Olympics, got onto the podium with a bronze. Ellen and the team competed in 77, learnt more. And then, but I came back in 80 after we boycotted, interestingly enough.
You've just skipped a whole decade, John. Okay. You're trying to get the podcast done and dusted.
All right, let's go back to your question.
Let's go back. I want to go back to that 74 America's Cup. I mean, I've heard you talk about sports psychology a lot over the years, the magic of team building particularly. It's a pretty modern phenomenon in sport. But back then, how important was that in that team? And what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, well, the turning point for me was the 76 Olympics in Montreal, where it became, and Joachim Schumann won the gold, Russia was second, and Australia, myself, was third in the Finn. And it became clear to me probably 3 or 4 months after that Olympiad that it was just as easy for me to have won the Olympic gold as it was the bronze. That it became very clear. The difference was decision-making under extreme pressure. It had nothing to do with my physical preparation or technical preparation. You know, I was fast, it wasn't an issue. It was my ability. And I remember Joachim being very close to me in one of the races, probably a metre behind, surfing down towards the leeward mark. I looked back and I made a decision, which I, in hindsight, should not have. And I skipped out one step between going from 1-to-1 purchase off the Finn mainsail to off the ratchet block. Mainsail went out, flipped backwards, finished the race in whatever it was, but in hindsight it could have been the gold medal just there, but there are other reasons. But that was a decision under extreme pressure. So, and I remember watching the East Germans, which was Joachim, with a whole bunch of people around him, and he was very calm, really calm. And this kid came, he was only 19 years old, I think, at the time, and no one had ever really seen him before. He came out of the Eastern Bloc. But he didn't seem to be nervous at all. And it became clear to me there was a lot of stuff going on here. And that's really when I started to get involved with this whole idea of the stuff between the ears, not the physical preparation. Because you've got to do the physical preparation, you've got to do to play the game, as you well know. But then ultimately it becomes down to decision making. So I felt that if I ever had a chance again, I'm going to be heavily involved in how to become mentally tougher under extreme pressure, you know, with being on the world stage. And that was the start of my journey on this whole world of sports psychology.
What did you learn at that moment about John Burchan, the sport?
I learned that if I was mentally tougher, I could have been much more successful. It was very simple.
So, John, back from the Olympics bronze medal, as you said, in Montreal, you declined Bondi's offer of another cup. Why? And how did that conversation go?
Well, Ellen asked me, yes, to be involved, but I was then focused on the 80 Olympics in the Solling class and one selection. And the pre-Olympics in Tallinn the year before, 79, it was second, pretty close to first. So we're a pretty hot team, and my dream was to win the Olympic gold. That was really the key, you know, having got on the podium, thank God, in 76. The difference between fourth and being on the podium is just like night and day, and I'm very proud of that medal. We didn't have any, again, no coaching, no money, no nothing, Australia. That's when the Australian Institute of Sport was set up, which is a game changer for sport in Australia after the 76 Olympics, because my medal was only one of four medals in total that the Australian Olympic team had won, including track and field and swimming. So Alan asked me to be involved, and now I was totally focused. And in fact, he helped me with some sponsorship for the Solling program, so good on him. anyway, we then, this country called Russia invaded Afghanistan, and the Australian, some Australian federations boycotted, others didn't. Certainly sailing did. And so the boat went, but we never went. Alan then called me and said, we need you over here to Newport. Can you come? This is halfway through the campaign. And I said, well, let's do it. And Raza, myself and the kids, we went across, and got involved in the Australia One 1980 campaign.
We'll talk about that in a second, but I want to come back to those 1980 games. You know, how hard was it then when you look back now, like many sailors around the world? It must have felt like it was your time. I mean, you knew how to put it together. You were one of the favourites for gold. How hard was that moment?
It was obviously difficult. I read about it in the newspaper that we're boycotting. They didn't even have the decency to call directly. You know, so the politics within the sport of sailing, and in most of these sports, you know, it was crappy. It wasn't good. So myself and my team had spent 3 years in Europe campaigning, getting ready, and to read about the newspaper that we weren't going was, you know, it was really tough. The federal government sent me a check for $2,000 for compensation, and that was it, and no recognition and no nothing. So, but life, you know, you move on. It's part of the deal. You know, you can't live in the past. And the campaigning, you know, sailing against people like Buddy Melgers and these characters, you know, just fantastic. Robbie Haynes. So it was a real, eye-opener to see these other characters, the way they operated as well.
I read a bit in your book about this time where you were you're pro sailing a little bit internationally, and Dennis Connor asked you to sail with him in an offshore race. Why did you think he asked you? And tell us the truth. What was he like to sail with, and what did you learn about him?
Yeah, well, I sailed on Willawar, which in the SORC regatta with Dennis. Yes, he asked me. Typical of Dennis, he'd be searching for talent. And that's one of the things, you know, very, very open-minded, very lateral thinking. You know, Dennis was a game changer within the world of America's Cup, within the world of Congressional Cup match racing. He'd have a big truck with all his equipment, even for the match racing. Everyone else was, you know, out of a briefcase, out of a, you know, a duffel bag. So I was working for North Sails then in preparation for setting up a sail loft in Australia. And, after the 76 Olympics, and primarily Dennis gave me a call, so let's do it. And we both won bronze medals in 76, so we knew about each other. So what did I learn from Dennis? Really interesting stuff. He would be asking advice of everyone on the boat, from the bowman right through to everyone, on different tactics, wind coming down. In other words, he was empowering people. Really interesting. Now, a lot of cases, you know, most of these people have never been asked their opinion at all, but that was Dennis. So in pre-start, he'd set the boat up, Willawar, so it was, I think it was probably a 47-footer. It was a Peterson design. And, you know, we're, let's say, 100, 200 metres from one of the pins. And he said, okay, how many seconds before we get there? And everyone would throw their thoughts in. So he was empowering the organisation from bow to stern. And it was really interesting in terms of team building. And that was Dennis's natural way of bringing people together for the race. Afterwards, he wasn't that interested in hanging out with the team. Very interesting. So it was kind of like a, you know, different split personality. But on the boat, very, very interesting character. And highly naturally talented as well. However, he told me that he'd never won a yacht race, even though he'd been trying, until he was about 15 or 16 years old. So he didn't see himself as naturally talented. He just felt that he knew how to work harder than other people and put it together. But very, very intelligent person.
Interesting. That's probably why he always prepared. You know, he no stone left unturned approach.
Yes, he wrote a book which was about, you know, if you're out practice, out fundraise, and there's no excuse to lose. And that's a pretty good starting point.
As you say, you were late into that 1980 campaign. campaign's not in great shape. You're late into it. What's your memories of that? How hard was it?
Well, it was really hard. First of all, in typical Bondi manner, Alan asked me to come across as a sales tactician on the boat. Well, Ben Lexon was tactician, and Jim was the skipper of the boat. And Ben read about it in the newspaper that I was coming across as tactician. So he got so mad, he put his fist through the wall and broke his wrist. So when I met Benny, he had a plaster cast. When I went into Newport, so we thought, my God, like, Benny, what did you do? So I broke, yeah. You know, but anyway, I found out that the guy was really pissed that I was observing his role. Well,
that's
then the question,
awkward.
Wow, awkward. It was really difficult. And Benny was, you know, he was right into the whole tactical thing with Jim. So then the question is, what do I do? And very interesting stuff. And this is, God bless her, Raza. I thought, look, there's no way I'm going to sail this port trimmer again, which I did all those years earlier. I'm going to, let's go home. This is bullshit. And Raza said, no, stick around. And that's advice I gave Ben Ainslie in 2012, when he was about to go home with that catamaran program all those years ago. So anyway, I stayed around, sailed as port trimmer, and as it turns out, best thing I could have done. We got hammered by the Americans yet again, but then at the last race, Alan sprang onto the stern of the boat and said, we're going to do this thing again, typical of Bond, never giving up. And in addition, Bertrand's going to be the skipper, without asking me, of course.
That's quite something. I mean, how did you feel about all of that and that role at that time?
Well, the role, I just did as best I could, but I felt that we're intimidated at the starts. And I remember at the Armory, which was the press centre, at one of the preliminary press conferences, and there was Jim Hardy and Dennis Connor up on stage. And I sensed the intimidation of the great US of A machine relative to the little Aussies. And again, I felt that just reinforced to me that if ever I had an opportunity, coming out of the 76 Olympics and then watching this thing in 1980 and watching the US of A and the US Coast Guard, US Navy, and just generally the way the Americans presented themselves, the high five thing, all of this stuff, I felt that if I ever had the chance myself, I wouldn't allow that to happen.
As you say, Bondi promised that next time it would be different. And he kept good to his promise, didn't he? More investment. Designer Benny Lexon, this time with money to invest in proper tank testing and computer power. He drew a radical design. What did you think, John, when you saw those very secret drawings?
Well, having been involved in a lot of turkeys in the past, America's Cups, Ellen and myself and Warren Jones, we flew across. We're doing the Admiral's Cup at the time in the Solent, based out of the squadron. We flew across in great secrecy, private jet, across to the Netherlands ship model testing facility in Holland. We flew into a military airport. It was wild stuff. And then, you know, literally black windowed cars and went to this. Anyway, Benny was there and he'd been working on keel development for probably 6 or 7 months with no real development, no real progress. But anyway, working with Fokker Friendship design engineers, he basically developed the whole wing keel scenario, but in collaboration with these people who were working on very high speed torpedo development using winglets, which was then a secret word. The concept of winglets was not talked about, but it was known. And so Benny then showed us the wing keel boat. I thought, my God, just give me just give us an equal boat and we'll play the game. And I thought, let's not do this. Let's not hang ourselves out to dry yet again. However, the computers, even though very, very rough at this stage, suggested this boat was going to be pretty quick. In fact, would you believe, the computer, and I'm sure Benny had dialed up the you know, the coefficients. He suggested, John, we're going to win every race by half an hour. Okay.
It's hard to say no.
So we built this thing, and with the option of also being able to take a conventional boat as well, which was Challenge 12, which is the sister ship to Australia 2, except it had a conventional keel. And built the boat, and radical. Like, you know, no one, Benny was a, he was an orphan, effectively, and he went to school at 9 and left at 12, so he was unteachable. And he was the most, he was the Leonardo da Vinci of our country. And I often think, you know, I have a double degree and all that sort of thing. And I remember a professor at MIT saying that, John, until you put a problem into numbers, you'll never be able to solve it. It, working with Benny and indeed with Alan Bond, it was, became clear to me that there's a lot more in decision making than just being able to put an equation together and solve it. And so with this whole wing keel, it was way out there. As it turns out, it's now quite common. But and when we, anyway, we went sailing the first day out at, over at Fremantle, spun it around a few times. It was just unbelievable. The boat could spin on its in its axis relative to a conventional boat. And Benny immediately said, "We've got to change it. There's new ideas. Let's change the stern." I said, "Benny, we haven't even sailed the boat yet." It was typical of his enthusiasm. His passion was fantastic. And of course, he was crazy to work with, you know, because everything was always changing. But regardless, the man was brilliant in, and he wasn't confined to thinking inside the box. This is my point about conventional education, because he was never really taught. But he studied birds. He was interested and interesting in everything he was about. So he was a student of life. He was a sponge, and he was an incredible entrepreneur and raconteur, and it showed up in terms of the way he conducted his life, you know, buying and selling Ferraris and God knows what, slept on our floor many times, you know, while doing, you know, all of this stuff. Is, you know, he was the godfather of our eldest son, Lucas. But bottom line is that we went sailing for the first time, Fremantle. And there was no difference upwind. We had identical sails with Challenge 12 on with our pace yacht. And then downhill, Challenge 12 just sailed away from us. And we thought, oh my God, so just a new world. So we had another world. So we had to solve that. And that was of great concern. And it took us a long while to figure out how we could get that boat to be competitive downwind.
That boat, of course, was Australia 2, one of the most iconic yachts ever to sail around an America's Cup racetrack. And that's where we're going to leave this edition. As John and his team of Aussies prepare to wrestle the America's Cup away from its permanent home in the New York Yacht Club. I probably don't have to tell you, but part two of this edition is about as exciting as it gets. John talks us through his memories of the 25th America's Cup and what it meant back home in Australia when the final race was over. To John for his time, a big, big thank you. As I said to John at the start of this podcast, he really is one of our sport's great communicators. And to share his memories with you all, well, it's an absolute privilege. So John and his wife, Rasa, many thanks for entertaining us. If you've enjoyed what you've heard and you'd like to support the podcast, please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. We work hard to bring you a real quality, ad-free listen. It takes a lot of time and planning, so it's lovely to have your support. Many, many thanks for that. And thanks too to the untiring enthusiasm and energy of the very wonderful Tim at Vertigo Films for producing these podcasts. Tim, also on behalf of our listeners, thank you. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lighthouse, you don't boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho.
That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the line line there.
We're looking at 10-5 and 42. Five. Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.